It's time for the Wisp Politics Book Club, celebrating Wisconsin authors and books about politics, government, and history.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jeff Mayers, president of WispPolitics.com, here for the Wisp Politics Book Club, and we're welcoming Amy Goldstein. She's the author of Janesville, An American Story, just published by Simon & Schuster. Welcome, Amy.
Good to be with you.
So, very interesting book, very timely, very important to Wisconsin. Do you have a Janesville connection, or how did you come to write a book about Janesville?
I don't have a Janesville connection, other than that I've gotten to know a lot of people over the last several years who've been very kind to let me into their lives as an author. I discovered Janesville because I was looking for a place to write about that was an ordinary place that had never been part of the Rust Belt and that lost a lot of jobs during the Great Recession. And I had heard about Janesville a few years before I began working on all of this. Somebody just mentioned to me that there was this Wisconsin town I'd never heard of before that had lost a big old General Motors plant, and it kind of stuck in my head. So when I began to think about a setting for this this long project I wanted to do, looking at kind of the ground-level effects of work going away, Janesville seemed like a good place.
Right, and you're a reporter with the Washington Post, and so this was a side project of yours, I take it, right?
It was a big side project. I began working on it the summer of 2011, and I've been, as you say, a very long-term, long-time reporter at the Washington Post. And my editors were gracious to give me some time off to work on this book, and sometimes I was working on this book while I was also covering my beat.
So what did you discover about Janesville? You didn't know much about it, but what's the essence of what you discovered there?
Well, I think I discovered a few things. You know, I was looking for a place that could be kind of a microcosm or a metaphor of what was happening in a lot of places in this country that have lost work and lost work of different kinds. But one of the things that attracted me to Janesville and that I think I, you know, grew to understand over time was that General Motors, and even before General Motors, Parker Pen Company, which also obviously comes out of Janesville, really were important to this community's identity. They had good jobs. They were jobs that people thought had lost would last forever. And when Janesville lost those jobs, it was really a very jarring experience. I mean, it was jarring for people who suddenly had no paychecks coming in, and these had been, particularly at General Motors, good paychecks. I mean, the UAW wages at the time the plant closed at the end of 2008 were $28 an hour, so that was good pay. So this was a jarring experience for individuals. It also really challenged the identity of the community. I think, you know, I've come to believe that Janesville is a pretty resourceful place. It's kind of the antithesis of a community that, when all this work went away, just kind of lay down and took it. I mean, they've been, you know, on an individual level and as a community level, people have been trying very hard to figure out what to do next. But it's a challenging thing to try to figure out what to do next.
Yes. I'm talking with Amy Goldstein, author of Janesville, An American Story. Now, there's a certain character in your book, and these are real-life characters. I don't mean to say that they're to infer they're fictional at all. They're real-life people. You profile them, and you're in their lives and relaying what's going on in their lives, the upset that the closing of the GM plant and the Lear plant, a major parts manufacturer, had on these people. And one in particular is interesting to me, the Mike Vaughn story. His father was a UAW GM worker. His grandfather was a UAW official GM worker. So briefly, can you tell the story of Mike Vaughn in terms of what he went through and then where he's at now?
Yes. The Vaughns are one of three auto worker families that I focus on in the story. And Mike had worked at, as you said, Lear Seating, which was a place that had about 800 workers at the end. So it was a big factory. And Mike was the shop chairman. He was the top union guy for this big factory. that was the largest supplier to the General Motors assembly plant in Janesville. And when his work went away, his wife's work had already gone away. I mean, they had met at Lear a number of years before. She lost her job before he lost his. One of the things that I found very touching was the first time he described to me what it was like to be able to stay at the plant until the bitter end because he had this union role. So after the two shifts of workers went away, he was there for a few more months as the last crew was basically taking apart the factory. He said, you know, it was piece by piece, it was going away until it was empty inside, which was, as he said to me, how he felt at the end.
Wow.
And he didn't know what he was going to do. I mean, he began to look for union jobs, looked on something called unionjobs.com. I mean, this had always been his identity. As you said, it was his family's heritage. The Vaughns are one of three families in Janesville that had had three generations of members on the UAW Local 95 Executive Committee. So Mike was the third generation of union Vaughns. And he found that he couldn't find a union job that made sense to me. I mean, he didn't want to do organizing. He wanted to do representing workers, and he didn't want to move too far from Janesville, which is something that a lot of people in town have felt. They're very rooted, anchored in this community. So he eventually went back to school to try to pivot to do something else. And when he thought about what might be the most logical something else, he thought about going into human resources management work, thinking that that could build on a lot of the skills that he had learned as a union leader. But if you think about the name of that kind of work, human resources management, it meant that Mike was going into the management side of things. And that he had to really think hard about. He came to think that that was okay, that he could educate workers from the management side as he had from the labor side. He ended up actually doing very well in school, and he's now working at a company in Janesville doing exactly the kind of work he trained for. Now, he started out, and this is true of many people in town, when he got his first job out of school. I mean, he felt very, very lucky to have this job. There were lots of people who were going back to school with him who weren't as fortunate in finding jobs in the field that they had studied. He did, so he felt really lucky, but he started out making much less money than he had at Lear. So there are all kinds of trade-offs. I mean, his income's going up over the last few years. He's gotten promotions. But, you know, even doing well means that you're not doing exactly what you were doing before.
Have you heard from him since the book came out?
I have. I actually saw him a weekend ago when I was in town. Saw him and his wife and his dad.
Have they seen the book?
They have, and they tell me they like it, which makes me very happy.
Yes. So there seems to be a question about whether retraining, all the money that's plowed in the retraining here and elsewhere works. Does it?
Well, I was very interested in taking a good look at retraining because it seemed to me that if you think about the economic policies in this country that Democrats and Republicans believe in, you know, there's not much intersection to those lists. But retraining is something that people all along the political spectrum tend to support. They may differ on the details, but they think it's a good idea. And it's what you hear. When jobs go away, people always say, well, go back to school to learn to do something different. So I was really interested in the question of how that worked in practice in this part of southern Wisconsin where there just weren't a lot of jobs to find. So with the help of a couple of labor economists, including a couple people who are at the University of Wisconsin, Madison, I took a statistical look at what happened to people who were unemployed around this time who did and did not go back to a school called Black Hawk Technical College, which is the main place in Janesville where people went back to school if they wanted to learn to try to do something else for a living. And much to my surprise, it turned out that retraining was not especially helpful. I mean, not that nobody got jobs or got good jobs, but on balance, it turned out that, you know, in the few years after all this work went away, the people who had gone back to school actually were doing less well than those who had not gone back to school, other people who were unemployed and had not gone back to school, in two ways. They had less likelihood of having steady work, meaning that they were working all four seasons of the year. And if you looked at the difference between pay before the Great Recession and a few years afterwards, the drop in pay was greater for those who had retrained.
So what's the answer?
Well, I mean, if you're asking me why did this happen, you know, I don't think that this is necessarily an indictment of the whole idea of retraining. But what I've come to think it shows is that, you know, no amount of good retraining, and I think that Blackhawk really worked hard to try to help these, you know, often frightened factory workers who hadn't been in school for half a lifetime or so become students. I mean, I think the college did a really admirable job. The college met with people in the local business community to try to figure out where jobs might be coming up and try to encourage the students coming back to school to go into those fields. But I think that no amount of skillful, well-intended retraining can make up for a lack of enough jobs in an area.
So boost the economy and maybe the retraining might take care of itself, or the new employers or the people who need the employees will do the training, perhaps?
Well, you know, there are various schools of thought about this. Some people think that it's just what you say, that, you know, if there's an environment in which there are waiting jobs and a demand for workers, then the employers have an incentive to help people get the skills they need to do those jobs. I think it plays out differently in different communities.
Okay, so there's a certain Janesville politician involved in this story, another character in your drama, your Janesville drama, and that's Paul Ryan. How would you define his role in all of this, trying to save the GM plant, trying to help people cope with it while he was in Congress with a job that had a national scope?
Well, you know, as you know, Paul Ryan, he calls himself fifth generation Janesville, so he's one of the people who has very deep roots in his hometown. And when the plant was closing, my book actually begins with a account of him getting a cell phone call and standing in his kitchen one night in early June of 2008, and the call was from the then CEO of General Motors, a guy named Rick Wagner, who was giving him a heads up that a public announcement was going to be made the next morning that the Janesville Assembly Plant was going to close. So that puts Paul Ryan right in the thick of things from the very beginning of all this. And, you know, having grown up in town, I mean, he had high school friends or the dads of high school friends or the, you know, kids of high school friends, you know, people he's known most of his lifetime who were losing work. So this wasn't a distant event for him. And at the beginning, he actually was quite involved, as you just alluded to, in an attempt to rescue the plant. Then Governor Jim Doyle, a Democrat, assigned a task force of people mostly from Janesville, but the state also worked very hard on this, to try to persuade General Motors to give another product to the Janesville Assembly Plant. And there were meetings of this group. Paul Ryan wasn't every one, but a member of his staff was often at these meetings. And there was a particular trip to Detroit to meet with the leadership of General Motors to try to present the case that Janesville deserved another product, another vehicle to keep it going. And Governor Doyle was at that meeting, and Paul Ryan was at that meeting. So he was pretty involved at the beginning.
Yes, but do you think that at the end of the day that, you know, obviously GM rebuffed the politicians on this. So at the end of the day, what's to save jobs like this in any manufacturing city? It's really up to the corporation, or is Trump changing the dynamic?
Well, I think it's a little early to say whether the current president, the new president, is changing the dynamic. But one of the things that I looked at was, as you say, Janesville tried very hard to persuade General Motors to reopen the plant with a new small car that GM was about to start manufacturing. Wisconsin had given General Motors the biggest economic incentive offer that the state of Wisconsin had ever made to anything in terms of trying to attract a business to the state. And Wisconsin folks thought they were really going to prevail. But it turned out that Michigan, which had a much higher unemployment rate at the time than Wisconsin, offered even more money to General Motors. And this new little car was now manufactured in Orion, Michigan.
Hmm. We should note that this was the oldest GM plant, and so there may have been an actual smart rationale from any corporation to not try to retrofit the oldest plant, but I don't know whether that came up in your research or not.
Well, that's part of why this plant was such a deeply ingrained part of Janesville's identity. It had been around for a long time. It began making tractors in 1919. And started producing Chevrolets in 1923. So this was a long-standing plant. In terms of how much that influenced GM's decision in terms of where to give the manufacturing rights for this new small car that it was about to start making, it's hard to say. It seemed that any plant that was going to start making a new model was going to have to go through some renovation. So whether the renovation would have been greater at Janesville than at this Michigan plant, it's a little hard to know. And the Michigan plant itself shut down for a while to be completely remade to produce this car. So I'm not sure how much that was centrally a factor.
Okay, I'm talking with Amy Goldstein, author of Janesville, An American Story. And we're coming up on our time limit here. But let me just ask you a couple more quick questions here. So, you spent a lot of time in Janesville, and I'm wondering after writing this book, whether you're optimistic about the future of Janesville?
Well, Janesville is a place that's been trying very hard. And talking to different people in town, you can hear different assessments of how things are going. In terms of the unemployment rate, Janesville mirrors what's been happening nationally in the last several years. I mean, the unemployment rate in Janesville had shot up to over 13%. Early in 2009, shortly after all these jobs went away. It's now just under 5%. So by that measure, it's doing much better. But if you look at what kind of work exists in town now and what people are being paid, it's not like it used to be. Now, there's a big economic development effort in town and in the county to keep trying to attract jobs, attract businesses to town. There's been some success. As I said, the jobs that are coming in, for the most part, are not paying what the old jobs used to be before they went away. And how much more Janesville can do in terms of propping up its economy, time will tell.
Yeah, and my final question is here, you went in search of a Janesville to tell us, to tell a certain kind of story, right? And so there are a lot of Janesvilles out there. And I'm just wondering whether, in a broader sense, do you have much optimism that, the Janesvilles of the world can survive what's going to be a huge economic transformation in the coming decades?
Well, I don't think I'm a very good prophet, particularly for a whole lot of communities that I haven't spent years trying to get to know. But I was struck. I've had a number of conversations in the days since my book has come out. And in one of those conversations, somebody was talking about having been from a Florida town that had lost its fishing industry. And somebody else was talking about coming from Maine, where that person's town had lost its shoe industry. And there were people talking about the coal industry having gone away. So I think that, or at least I hope, that the story that I'm telling about Janesville will really ring true for people in lots of parts of the country that know nothing about the Midwest and nothing about auto workers, but know something about the fragility of work in this country.
Okay, well, that's a good way to end, and we hope people read your book, Janesville, An American Story. Thank you, Amy Goldstein, and thank you to the listeners of the WISP Politics Book Club. We'll see you next time.
The WISP Politics Book Club is brought to you by generous sponsors. See them in the archive of these podcasts at wispolitics.com.